The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. And our veteran today is Eric Zimmerman. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Frank.
Tell me, first of all, what made you or attracted you to the Army?
I think the Army was a great source of a way to serve. And really, the Army was the choice because my sister was in the Army. My older sister, she was an Army doc, and I really looked up to that. What's interesting is much later in my career, I was sitting down with an operational psychologist for a different program I was moving into, and you know, she said, "Describe your family and what do all your siblings do?" And so I told her about my brother, who's a firefighter in Maryland. I told her about my sister, who was an Army doc, and I told her about my other brother, who was a missionary then in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and she said, "Boy, you really have a strong service-oriented family." And I had never. Yeah. It took somebody to, you know, kind of from the outside, point that out to me and mm-hmm. said, "Oh, that's really interesting." And you know,
came to you naturally.
It did, and a very much a testament to the values instilled by my mom and dad.
Mm-hmm. So, what was your MOS, military specialty?
I started off as a young officer in tanks in mm-hmm. the armor branch, and then after that, I transitioned to military intelligence. The Army has a really neat program where they know they need a lot of young officers in what are called the combat arms, yeah. infantry, armor, and artillery. Mm-hmm. And not so many. That pyramid really gets inverted and the jobs get fewer as you move up. And so I knew from the start I had 4 years to bump around on tanks, and then I would go to the intel school and be an intel officer for the rest of my career. So mm-hmm. first 4 years in tanks and then intel.
So what's it like to be in a tank? Were you ever in a battle in a tank?
No, I just missed Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. I watched Desert Storm from my house because it happened yeah. while we were on break from college. I was an ROTC guy from the State University of New York. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun to be on tanks. Let me tell you. One thing you do in ROTC is they send you to this camp at Fort Bragg. It's not in Fort Bragg anymore, but they introduce you to all the branches. So yeah. everybody kind of puts on a good show in the
yeah.
And then for the tank portion, they put you in a little spider hole in the middle of the road and had a tank drive over you. And you're like, "Oh, that's pretty cool." So that was a fun introduction. And that was a fantastic first 4 years in the Army because, you know, on a tank crew, there's only four guys. Mm-hmm. And so even though you're the second lieutenant, you're the one who's the least experienced. Mm-hmm. And so approaching that with really ears open to learn, you really learn about leadership with your four guys yeah. inside the tank and then the four tanks that are assigned to you. So yeah. it's a small unit, 16 people.
And our young officers learn from the enlisted folks.
Absolutely.
In a lot of careers, really all of them. Yeah.
And that continues all the way up.
Yeah.
So at every grade as a young officer, you get assigned a much more senior and seasoned mm-hmm. NCO. Mm-hmm. And so as a second lieutenant, platoon leader, I had a platoon sergeant who had a lot of years in the Army and taught me a great deal, and I still am in contact with him through social
awesome.
Media to this yeah. day. And then as a captain, you get a first sergeant, and then as a lieutenant colonel commander, you get a sergeant major. And so that pairing is fantastic mm-hmm. throughout your Army career as you go up. Even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has a senior enlisted leader
that's right.
who's always there to kind of, you know, keep you on the right azimuth.
Give the perspective of the young troop. That's wonderful. I think the Air Force is into that now, but it wasn't so much when I was a second lieutenant. But.
Yeah, the Army calls the NCOs the backbone of the Army, mm-hmm. and there couldn't be a more truer phrase
yeah.
because
yeah.
these are the folks that absolutely make the Army run.
So what took you to intel?
I asked for it, so mm-hmm. I was very, very fortunate. As an ROTC cadet, you get a wish sheet and you uh-huh. put your list, And I was extremely fortunate. I had Intel as number one, and I think I had Armor as number three. And so I kind of got the lucky star and got both of those and got to experience both of those.
Awesome. Take me through what Intel is. What, you know, when your mother asks you, what is intelligence?
So my wife says I'm the weatherman.
Or your
so,
wife.
Yeah, as I transitioned into being a young Intel officer, as a young captain, you're an S2, the Intel. So the staff structure, the S1 is the personnel person, and the S2 is the Intel person, and the S3 is the ops, and goes on. And so really what I was taught at Fort Huachuca at that tactical level is you have to worry about enemy, weather, and terrain. So you figure out those three things. And so I repeated that mantra to my wife because she said, what do you do now? And so what stuck with her was, you're the weatherman. And I was like, oh, okay. And so that
you're
continued.
Friends with the weatherman.
Yeah, that continued throughout the entire career. There is no weather officer in the Army, unlike maybe the Air Force, who really needs to know about the weather. We care if it's muddy and raining and when it's dark and when it's light, that kind of those things that impact military tactical operations. Funny.
I did not know that. I figured you had your own weather people.
No, we draw on the Air Force.
Yeah.
Right? Part of that kind of everybody has their own specialty, and that's the Air Force, and so we would draw that. Now, moving into Intel, really, you're sort of that person who's going to synthesize all of those different sources of information to try to give the best understanding of the bad guys that you can so that commanders can make decisions. So whether that's things we've heard, things we've seen, things that scouts have observed, how do you synthesize that all in? And, you know, as a young guy, you have to learn how the enemy fights. So based on what we've seen, this is kind of how we think the enemy is fighting. Then the commander can use that in his decision calculus and figure out, okay, how are we going to get after our mission to do whatever it is, to take that hill, to you know, hit the cliche.
That's a very succinct definition.
Then it moves on from that into all of these other branches and specialties. Everything from imagery intelligence and signals intelligence. I was fortunate to be assigned to a counterintelligence unit as a young major, and so that kind of changed my career, because at that point I realized, hey, this is a really fascinating part of our enterprise, is how do we stop the bad guys from getting after us and stealing our secrets. And so that kind of helped guide my career for about the last 15 years of my career. Was much more specialized, and so I had a much different Army career for the back half of my career. The first half was very traditional, all the gear, going out in the woods, getting wet, getting dirty, and the last half of my career was much more strategic intelligence.
Great. What were some of your postings that you remember?
I think the fondest I have is Germany. What just crossed my mind was I was very blessed to have the Army G2 do my retirement ceremony. And so she was just getting a little card ready of like, where have you been, Eric? And we were listing all the things, and she said Germany, Hawaii, Savannah. And she just listed them all, and she said, boy, you've avoided all the bad places, right? Nobody likes Fort Polk, Louisiana, no offense. Nobody likes Fort Hood, Texas. And so I had, again, a very blessed career. But Germany, very fond of. I started my career there in tanks, and what a great place to be a tanker. Being overseas is very different. Being overseas is a camaraderie that I really enjoyed. I was brought up in that, and coming back to the States, it's a little bit different. I think being overseas just draws that community closer together. Families too. And it's much more of a small, close-knit esprit de corps. And when you come back to America, everybody lives everywhere. And you know, a weekend hits and we're not going skiing in the Alps. A weekend hits and everybody goes their own ways. And so that was a great way to be brought into the Army family and understand that this is very much a people-centric affair. And so I've really worked on carrying that forward in assignments I had throughout. Hawaii was pretty nice. I'm a kid from Central New York, so going to work in Hawaii, the Navy ran a boat across Pearl Harbor for us that lived on the west side of Pearl Harbor, and I was pretty keen to motor past the Arizona on your way to work every day.
Wow.
So, yeah, Hawaii was pretty special.
Yeah, I've only been passing through there.
It's worth a visit.
Seems lovely. What are some other
In the States, I've been in D.C. several times. I've been in Fort Meade a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Army, what used to be called the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, now the Army's Counterintelligence Command, is at Fort Meade. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my jobs were at Meade. I did Fort Belvoir. I did the Pentagon. My wife very much liked Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and mm-hmm. I think it was just our circumstances. Our son was 2 at the time, maybe a little younger.
Good beef barbecue, too.
Oh, boy. You can't beat that barbecue. Although, as a fairly new North Carolinian, my wife and I have made our way across the state sampling the barbecue.
North Carolina, east and west.
North Carolina discussion. Gives Kansas City definitely a run for its money. I've had fantastic barbecue here. My. Really liked, I was at Fort Stewart, Georgia for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so Savannah is a beautiful town.
Yeah.
That was nice to be in the southeast, although summers were a tad warm.
Uh-huh.
Especially in uniform and in gear and bumping around in the pine forests of beautiful Fort Stewart, Georgia. And that, I think, is it. I kind of stuck it in and out. Went to school in Fort Huachuca, so that was mm-hmm. a different part of the country for us. And so
that's, Arizona?
Yep, is that's it? The mm-hmm. Army's Intel mm-hmm. School, yeah. mm-hmm. south of Tucson, close to the Mexican border. Mm-hmm. And so that was fun. You got to, there's some safety concerns now, but we could go bump across the border and have just fantastic food and mm-hmm. come back across. And that was a little bit different time. They're a little worried about safety now.
Yeah,
so
that's a shame.
It is.
So just for the record, what different posts did you serve at?
So I think about 6 in the States, Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, Fort Stewart, Fort Meade, Fort Huachuca, the Pentagon, and then Fort Belvoir, mm-hmm. and then Germany, Hawaii, a year in Iraq, and then some quicker times in Kuwait, mm-hmm. in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty good number. I got a bunch of passport stamps for it.
What kind of memories, humorous or disastrous, can you share?
Oh, the list is long. There used to be a Reader's Digest thing called Humor in Uniform, and
I still read it.
There is always funny stories about your time in the Army or in the military. I was a young platoon leader in tanks, and we were getting tested on how well we could do our tactical tasks, and this was a defense. So you dig the tanks in, the engineers come out with the big bulldozers, and they dig you holes, and we know the bad guys are going to look at the terrain and, you know, drop artillery on the spot, so you dig your holes there, but you actually hide behind that, and then when, you know, somebody sees the bad guys, you all get up and you can engage them with the main guns and, you know, save the day and stop the bad mm-hmm. guys. And so we had, and of course it's at night because, mm-hmm. you know, nothing good happens after midnight, as my wife says. So we had dug in and we had rehearsed the movement, and we had one of our tanks was up. And so they were the eyes, and they said, mm-hmm. okay, the bad guys are here. And we actually have, you know, other Army units that play the bad guys because they're getting training out of that too. And so they were there, and he calls us all up, and, you know, you've got to give commands to the platoon, and you're getting tested on how well you can run your 4 tanks, and you have to be the tank commander of your own tank that you're on. So I said, driver, move out. And we moved out, and it's dark, and mm-hmm. he has a night vision sight that he can put in his little driver's position, and he pulls us out but he missed our hole. And he missed the hole. So if you picture a tank as a big rectangle, and then the hole that the engineers dig you is another big rectangle, and in a perfect world, your gun can look out over the front. But we missed it by about 6 feet to the left. And so as we drove in, and we're driving fast, right, because we've got to react to this threat, and we drove in, and the next thing I know, our tank is tilted at about 45 degrees or higher, because the right side of the tank is in the hole and the left side of the tank is outside of the hole.
Man.
And so, of course, everything goes flying. My loader, who's on the left side of the tank, is laying on top of me. And I'm thinking, that's bad, because anytime you need the mechanics to come bail you out, you owe them a rack of beer, which is not good. You don't want to be in that position owing the mechanics.
I want to be that guy.
And I'm being graded on this thing as a young officer, right? Like this is your report card of how well you can do this. And so the major, who at that time seemed very old as a brand new lieutenant, came over to me and kind of, you know, looked me in the eye, which is odd because I am down. He hands me back my map, which had flown off the tank, and he said, you should probably turn the fight over to your platoon sergeant. So I did that, and then we carefully backed in and out as the battle is raging. We're worried about backing out of this hole and predicament that we've put ourselves in, because if you picture a tank, it's got the tread along the wheels, and that thing flies off. That's a bad day, because then you're not driving anywhere. So we carefully had to extricate ourselves from that, and we did, and I think we passed the test, but barely. Probably.
That's called learning.
Barely.
The hard way.
Another point, we were shooting gunnery, and as a tanker, how well you shoot as a crew is really important. And how well you shoot as a platoon is also important. So you go up and you shoot your tank, you shoot all the weapons, and you get a score on that. And then you've got to fight the whole platoon. And you do a run in the day, and then you wait for nightfall, and you do the second half at night. And there's three platoons in a company. Two of us did horrible during the day. Just bad as you can do, in danger of not getting there. And the company commander taught me a lot about directed leadership at that point. And so in the interim, as we're waiting for the sun to go down, we're getting the tanks ready for the night shoot, and he calls over the other platoon leader. He's talking to him very calmly. Hey, you can do this, patting him on the back, you know, let's get after it. If you get a good night run, you'll pass and it'll be good. Now go on your way. So I walk over there. He's sitting in his Humvee, and he takes his helmet off, and he throws it. He breaks his windshield, and he throws his stuff down and hurls a stream of invectives and things we can't say on the air, and says, you better fix this. And that was the guidance I got. And in hindsight, and so the night run went. I think we did okay, because I didn't get fired. But it was a really interesting case study, as you look back at it, of how he felt. The first guy needed a little pat on the back and a little confidence, and I needed a kick in the seat of my pants. And both of those kind of got the same result, because we none of us were fired after we left there. But it was just a really interesting experience of leaders knowing their people and knowing what they needed to kind of get them to the, in this case, back to an acceptable standard.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting. I'm learning a lot listening to you.
When we were off air, you mentioned Korea, and I had an office on Pearl Harbor, which was fantastic. I was a lieutenant colonel, and one day the there was a knock at the door, and this is a skiff, a sensitive compartmental facility, right? You're not supposed to get in, not supposed to have visitors. So a little knock on the door, and there's this little old guy out there. I said, can I help you? And he said, I used to work in this building. And so the building we were in was Puller Hall. It was an old Marine Corps barracks, probably built in the 20s, on Pearl Harbor for the Marines that were stationed at Pearl. And so this guy came in and said, I was a Marine here in 1949. I said, come on in.
Oh, my God.
So we got to bring him in. And he said, what is this now? And I took great delight in telling him it was an Army office on a Navy base in an old Marine Corps barracks. And he wasn't too happy with that. But we actually took him upstairs. He kind of looked around trying to find where his bunk was. And so it turns out this little old guy, his wife was outside, so we brought her in. They were on vacation in Hawaii from somewhere in the States. 1949, young Marine, living the dream in Hawaii, Korean War breaks out. So months later, he's in the Chosin Reservoir, fighting for his life from the North Koreans, the Chinese, and the bitter cold. Mm-hmm. Just it's fascinating who you meet and who you run into, and really gives you a sense of history that our service, and it was there long before we got there. We do our part, and it will be there long after. And it's our job while we're there to really honor that memory and honor those that went before us. What a great story. He linked us up with the local chapter of the Chosin Reservoir survivors who then came to the office and gave a more formal presentation on the hell that these guys went through. And, you know, just little old guy bumping around Hawaii in his Hawaiian shirt with his family.
Very, very interesting. What would you say to, do you run into people who are thinking about maybe the parents of kids who are thinking about going in the military? What do you find?
I do. One of the things that's really interesting is this really low percentage now of folks that have served that understand what it means to wear the uniform in defense of this great nation. And I really encourage folks to, you have to want to serve. I'm blessed to have to know a lot of people and really have met just heroes who have done great things and at great cost to them. And so that understanding of why you're drawn to the service, and, you know, everyone's drawn for a different reason, right? It helped me pay for college, even though there was this noble idea behind it of service that was, you know, bumping around in my teenage years. It helped me pay for college.
Yeah.
And so all those things that bring us there then are kind of molded into this Army ethos of what's gone before. Why are we here? What is this Constitution that we are sworn to uphold and defend? And really those things are just so important. And so if I had a chance to talk to parents, and I haven't done it too much, just some small numbers, but really it's understanding okay, why are you drawn here? And really, this is greater than self. This is the definition of a calling that is greater than self.
Yeah.
There are many, but this is one.
I'm amazed at how many people have, veterans have gone over to Ukraine at their own expense to fight.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Some have been killed. Mm-hmm. Some have been killed. And I think that, you know, this continues a long tradition. We had the French, really, who before France was involved, we had a lot of Europeans come to America to help in our revolution.
Yeah, we wouldn't have made it without the French,
right? But excuse me, we even sent pilots would either go to Canada or they would go straight to England to help fight for England at the start of the Second World War before we were involved. The Spanish Civil War had a whole international brigade, and so this very much continues a long tradition of folks who put their ideals into action in a very, very dangerous way.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about running for public office?
I have not. I think my service is more was definitely more on the Department of Defense side. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'd be a politician. Plus, there's the mechanics of it. So I was born and raised in New York for the first 22 years of my life in God's country in central New York, and then I've lived where the Army's told me for 30 years after that. And
you're brave to say that in North Carolina.
And, you know, and now I'm a very proud, very happy North Carolinian. So I don't even know where I'd run if I ran.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. We have a lot of veterans in Congress now. Mm-hmm. Tremendous.
Yeah, and I think that's a fascinating dynamic because, you know, Congress has the power to, mm-hmm. to make war, which mm-hmm. is an awesome power. And having people in Congress who have seen war, especially now with the past 20 years, and these are veterans who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think understanding the cost of those wars is very important for politicians who are trying to look at what is hopefully this last resort of foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To get in back into something more light, what'd your family think about all the moves?
It's a great question. I would hesitate to answer for them. my wife, I think, very much enjoyed. She has a great story she tells, and we met in college, State University of New York at Brockport, and she knew I was in ROTC, but she didn't really know what it meant.
Yeah.
And you know, with our program, a smaller program, a lot of folks went into the Guard, stayed right there in New York, went in the Reserves, stayed right there in New York, or went active duty like me and get orders to Fort Knox, Kentucky on route to Germany. And so she really didn't kind of know what she was signing up for. but, you know, we're in our second decade of marriage, and mm-hmm. so she did okay. And I don't think I'd be I certainly wouldn't be the soldier I was without her support.
Yeah, it takes teamwork.
My son's seen a lot of schools, and it's so funny because I was K through 12 in the same school. I graduated with roughly the same 100 kids that I started kindergarten with, give or take a few.
Gee whiz.
So that was my upbringing. Mm-hmm. I still keep in contact with some of those folks. He has seen all of these other schools. He's graduated in Germany. And so for him, it was a much different experience.
Well, Eric, we could probably have you back for more, but I'm going to stand up and salute a veteran, Eric Zimmerman, who joined us here, Army colonel, terrific background, and a fine American. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks so much.
And that wraps up our time for this edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and you'll find most of our readings there as well. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. See you next time.